Hey all, I need to make the following disclaimer about the following show. As I had recorded it a day and a half ago and put it up in sort of an expedited fashion, I was discussing the progeny, the offspring, the children of one Ozzy Osbourne, and I made the statement that he had two children, which is in a weird and obscure way true, as Jack and Kelly are the two that are actually predominant in the spotlight. But apparently, his third daughter, Amy, was forgotten about by me, and now I've been reliably informed that from a previous marriage, there are at least two other children that I know about. There could be more. I don't want to get in the weeds with that. I just wanted to assure the listener that I do try to do my research on this, and it was just something with which I was not aware. So we'll just move on from there, and I hope the rest of the show you find it informative, enjoyable, and somewhat contemplative. Thank you. In 1985, a giant conglomeration of the world's most esteemed pop stars crowded into a recording studio under the guidance of Quincy Jones to form the supergroup known as USA for Africa and record a single that would become the eighth best-selling single of all time. We Are the World was recorded to raise funds to alleviate the suffering in the 1983 to 1985 Ethiopian famine. Aside from people like Michael Jackson, the event brought together some of the era's best-known recording artists to include Bruce Springsteen, Cyndi Lauper, Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, and Tina Turner, amongst a giant host of others. Not to be outdone, a few months later, Ronnie James Dio, along with guitarist Vivian Campbell and bassist Jimmy Bain, would assemble the hard rock and heavy metal superstars to record a song called Stars, under the album title name Here in Aid. And this was an attempt to achieve parity with the contributions from the other end of the musical aisle, as it included contributions from Tommy Aldridge, Blue Oyster Cult, Dawkins, Jafria, Judas Priest, Motley Crue, Night Ranger, Ted Nugent, Queensryche, Quiet Riot, Rough Cut, Twisted Sister, Vanilla Fudge, Wasp, and Y&T, as well as a parody band known as Spinal Tap, who performed in character. None of this was contingent on live performances. All the funds were based on album sales. So when Ronnie James Dio's 2010 death from stomach cancer would precipitate the Dio Cancer Fund, which by the way continues to this day with fundraisers that cater to rock and metal fan bases, although not excluding anyone, it still seems like small potatoes compared to those two previous efforts. So on July 6th of this year, I became aware of a live event, one that had all the publicity one could ask for, one that raised funds for an issue that directly affected the progenitor and the namesake, and one that does so while the namesake was still alive. In fact, in one day, it raised $190 million for Parkinson's research and for charities in Birmingham, England, all because of the profuse love a single artist has maintained with his audience, who, in a world of auto-tune, AI, flash, fakery, and fluff, has managed to find a way to connect to the everyday listener. And like him or not, and aside from the fact that his name was invoked at the height of satanic saturation as I was growing up, I learned to love the guy behind the image, his humor, his honesty, and his blue-collar sense of humanity, and his ability to make an auditorium love him as the affable clown he has always been, even if most of his catalog was out of my wheelhouse. So today I'll discuss the final concert, gargantuan fundraiser, and swan song of a guy who undeniably made a mark on the world. Your mileage may vary, good, bad, or otherwise. A man who not only knew and fully realized that his candle was fading on July 6th of this year, but would see it fully extinguished at last 17 days later. Today we'll talk about Ozzy Osbourne. And this is box number 7. In his autobiography titled Iron Man, Black Sabbath guitarist Tony Iommi speaks with great and unfiltered affection for his best friend, Ozzy. Even in the early days, Ozzy was the one who seemed to simply trust those around him with no hedging skepticism or penchant for self-preservation. Just a simple childlike undercurrent in his personality, and it made him easy prey for pranksters. Iommi himself recalls the early days of their band practices and how they had to drive Ozzy home late at night at the end of the day, and Ozzy would inevitably fall asleep in the bottom of the van, and because those blue-collar neighborhoods all had the same patina, shape, street structure, and architectural similarities, they would drive deliberately to the wrong block and then wake up Ozzy, who would stumble out of the van and be the silent victim of his friend's laughter as he sleepily tried to enter the front door of a house that didn't even belong to him. Now, this is funny on its face as an anecdote and as a story, and definitely the camaraderie of friendship, as previously referenced in the podcast right before this, but it's that type of affable clown that would be the connecting tissue between a lead singer who was not a prodigious vocalist and an audience who would come to love him with such a deep affection for the kind of turnout that they saw on July 6th. Even in my own childhood, Ozzy Osbourne did not come without controversial warnings. I was warned about the occultic influences of his music. I was warned about the dark messaging behind certain songs. And I was warned about his fascination with Aleister Crowley. And granted, all of those things were true to varying degrees. Ozzy Osbourne had definitely set himself up as the theatrical fallen angel in the world of heavy metal, and his brief dalliances with the occult and his fascination with Crowley came and probably went, but his personality kept going. Then there would be an incident that would simultaneously propel him into the world of infamy and ultimate categorical perdition amongst cautious parents, the famous Bat Incident. Now, if you listen to the surface narratives that were handed down all these years, you were treated to the idea that Ozzy was leading a black mass on stage and picked up a bat and bit its head off to solidify the bloodletting surrounding the dark ceremonial requirements. But in reality, the story goes like this. It was 1982. Ozzy was performing in Des Moines, Iowa. A 17-year-old fan threw a bat on stage. The tossing of items, of course, being a frequent happening at rock and roll concerts, and Ozzy, thinking it was a toy bat, decided to play along with the theatrical nature of the offering, picked it up, stuck the head in its mouth, bit down, felt the bones crunch, and realized that he was chewing on the head of an actual, potentially rabid piece of bat fauna. This incident resulted in two things. One, a narrative that would build to ridiculous proportions to the point that people were claiming that Ozzy was sacrificing goats on stage from town to town. The other was not so vainglorious. A series of painful precautionary rabies shots. A set of 24 in all that Ozzy would recount as one of the most horrific moments of his life and the most painful as well. So those outside the realm of his career chalked the entire thing up to this fervent Satanism that never really was a part of his ultimate character. Those that knew anything about the man realized that Ozzy was simply that young guy in the back of a Birmingham van waking up and being shown the front door of a house that didn't belong to him. And Ozzy, wanting to please people, walked right in. Now, Ozzy admits that his drug use was almost impossible in proportion. His alcohol use, his infidelity with his wife Sharon, and all of these things readily sitting on the surface of his life, and never once out of all of this did he find the compartment to lie about any of it. And in the middle of this, he managed to raise two children who, to this day, love him dearly, maintain and keep a marriage that should have ended, but didn't, only at the behest, of course, of his wife Sharon, that decided to look past the veil and the surface sins and realize there was more to Ozzy Osbourne than his surface behavior. One particular interview he gave revealed a real sense of hilarity while being questioned about his periods of sobriety.
And what happened with Black Sabbath? We all ended up junkies and alcoholics and everything. Like the drummer ended up in a rehabilitation center. I did. for a while, and in the end, disaster happens. It's inevitable to happen, disaster, because it's like drugs. They were okay at the time, but we outgrew them, you know. We just, you know, we took LSD, we took cocaine, we took vast amounts of marijuana. It was fun at the time, but then we all just sort of thought this ain't a really good idea anymore.
Of course, it must be said that Ozzy's deep British accent is sometimes hard to understand. If you're used to him, it's quite interpretable. But however, these statements that he just made to the reporter, of course, beg the obvious question, which, of course, the reporter asks. And Ozzy, never one to miss a beat, responds perfectly.
So you have a more stable life now?
No.
Ozzy is also known for his heartfelt dedication to his first principal guitarist. As a matter of fact, his dedication to all of his guitarists. But the main one of his solo career at the very beginning, Randy Rhoads, who famously was killed in a plane crash while on tour with Ozzy. A story for another day, but it was commonplace carelessness and male bravado that caused the crash, and not inebriation or the usual pratfalls of rock and roll. And is an incredibly sad story and touching at the same time. So you might ask, as a listener to my show, why am I talking about Ozzy Osbourne? Well, that concert 17 days ago, or at least the footage I saw of it, testified to literally millions of people watching the final arias of a man with whom deep affection in their heart had been cultivated. Was it all of his music that brought it about? No. Was it an exemplary voice? Not at all. Was it his ability to vocally scrape the rafters and sing fast, interpretive scales? Again, absolutely not. It was the simple fact that the man in front of them was the same man that they have seen since the late 1960s when he first entered the consciousness. A guy with a simple voice, who sang simple melodies, and who always brought his audience in at the ground level. There was nothing about his musical royalty that demanded worship, and yet a man with simple skills was able to acquire the greatest guitarists that the generations have seen in many years, especially in the genre. So while Ozzy Osbourne may not be everyone's cup of tea and his music even is no longer a part of my personal mosaic, I'm here to say that I get it. And when they announced that he passed away today after 17 days after the final concert, I had a large lump in my throat. A deep affection for the lovable, huggable man who sometimes did and said controversial things, but always maintained his blue-collar appeal to the world and his sense of humor. You see, the majority of pop music today is a construct, a phony, Potemkin village of fraudulent hucksters, mediocre vocalists, auto-tuned leads, and AI-generated music and personas. And while there are a few real talents out there, your chances of seeing a pop diva perform live without lip-syncing is going down drastically day by day. Ozzy's final show in Birmingham places him squarely in the throes and suffering of Parkinson's disease, confined to a chair, limbs shaking, and belting out a surprisingly emotional goodbye, the song, Mama, I'm Coming Home, to a tearful throng of his fans. We don't have to take the roads Ozzy did in any fashion. Whether it be in terms of pharmacology, whether it be in terms of spirituality, whether it be in terms of sobriety. But if there is something to be learned from the man, it is tell the truth and never compromise on the authenticity, even when it hurts. Why am I covering this? Because he's part of my history too. And I think that history matters, at least today. I'll close with this simple social media proclamation I put up when I heard the news today. Ozzy's career invoked a myriad of responses, and point taken. But the outpouring of affection you will see in the next few weeks will be born not from his controversial aspects. It will be because he was the height of authenticity and humor, a walking catalog of normalcy, and damaged goods on display. So long, Ozzy. And this is box number 7.